Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Scuba. Welcome to the show. I'm Scuba. This is the Not a Diving Podcast. Okay, this is episode 98 of the show. I'm getting tantalizingly close to the 100 mark. It's also nearly the end of the year. We're trying to figure out what we're going to do over Christmas. We might have a break, which would mean the 100th episode would be in January. But TBC on that. We'll have full info, full news next week on episode 99. Wow. 99 episodes. I actually can't believe that we've got this far with this project. But here we are. Here we are with it. And I have to say, I'm enjoying it as much as I did on episode one, really. So long may it continue, I guess. Long may it continue. Okay, what do we got on the show this week? Well, it's a genuine legend of electronic music, really. It's A-Track. He won the DMC World Championships at the age of 15. Can you believe that? Can you imagine that? DMC, especially at that time, it was 1997 that he won it. At that time, was in the culture just a legendary thing. I mean, like to have the status of a DMC World Champion, I mean, at any time, but particularly I think in that era, that was really the heyday of, I guess, traditional turntablism. That status is just unbelievable. And to achieve that at 15 is just, I mean, it is mind-blowing. It genuinely is. And since then, he's really had a career which is completely unique, I think. I can't think of anyone, really, who's done the same stuff, you know, the same breadth, certainly in these areas anyway. And yeah, he's just gone on to really impressive things. For example, the Duck Sauce project with Armin van Helden, which spawned, you know, genuine hit records. He's run a label for 15 years, which we talk about. He's been Kanye West touring DJ, which we also discuss. Just a ton of different things. And he's managed to straddle different genres. I think that's maybe the most impressive thing, because when you come up with something like turntablism, which is so niche, the ability to go from that to being a genuinely multi-genre kind of artist is really impressive. And I think that speaks to a serious talent, if that wasn't obvious already, from achieving that stuff at such a young age. But yeah, just great to have him on. He's been doing the podcast circuit recently, as we mentioned, but I think we get some stuff out of him that he hasn't talked too much about in the past, I think, I hope. Yeah, just great to have him on, really. So just before we get started, a reminder that you can support the show on Patreon, patreon.com/scubaofficial. There are two tiers, the solidarity tier, which costs £3.50 a month or $4 US, and that gets you bonus podcasts and other stuff, entry into the private area of our Discord server, etc. And the musicality tier, which is £8.50 a month or $10 US, which gets you all that stuff, plus all the music that we release on Hot Flush Recording. So you will have got my digital underground mixtape in high quality download formats a good few weeks ahead of the release. And that's true for all of the stuff that we release on Hot Flush and the other labels that we run too, like Who Whom and Rhythm Nation, although we haven't done a Rhythm Nation for a while. But yeah, we do release a lot of music, and it's a kind of equivalent, I suppose, of a Bandcamp subscription, which we don't do on Bandcamp, although visit hotflush.bandcamp.com. But yeah, we don't do a subscription there. But musicality tier Patreon basically gets you that, plus all the other stuff too, so the bonus podcasts and other business. So yeah, do that if you fancy doing it. You can also donate to the podcast without a subscription. scubaofficial.io/support contains a couple of options to do that there via PayPal or credit card or whatever. That's a nice thing to do, and people do that. So if you're enjoying the show, then that's a way of showing your appreciation. If you don't want to support financially, that's completely understandable and completely cool. Hit the 5-star button wherever you're listening to this podcast. Follow the show wherever you're listening to this podcast, on Apple or Spotify or whatever. Hit the follow button. That really helps. You could leave a gushing review as well. That would be good. All of those things are good. There's also a Spotify playlist which contains all the music, or lots of the music that we talk about on the show, plus all the episodes. There's a link in the show notes to that Spotify playlist. And I mentioned the Discord, hotflushrecordings.com/discord. You can get in there if you're a supporter or not. And we'd love to have you in there. There's a great bunch of people talking about the show and other things too. So yeah, once again, hotflushrecordings.com/discord. Okay, without further delay, here is A-Track. A-Track, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Hey, thank you. I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm all right, thanks. I actually, I played Paddle for the first time this morning, and I've been really struggling. Definitely hit that age where, like, strenuous exercise, or certainly new kinds of strenuous exercise, it's a lot, basically. But
I didn't play Paddle today.
I'll do my best to stay awake. I'm not making any promises. But anyway, yeah, great that we're doing this finally. You've been doing the rounds podcast-wise, I realize. Is there a reason for that? Have you got some big thing going on that I should know about before we start?
No.
Recording this?
Okay. No, I don't know. I don't know. These things come in phases, I guess. But yeah, I was on our mutual friend Will Clark's podcast a month or two ago. And then, well, some stuff that I did recently, I guess, is centered around the fact that this year is the Fool's Gold 15th anniversary. We've had some events all year, and there's a few that are coming up now, like the last two anniversary events of the year. So done some stuff around that. But aside from that, I don't know, maybe people see me on one thing and they're like, oh, let's get him.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay.
I hope, or maybe they hate it. I don't know.
Well, that's a good sign if you're getting repeat bookings, I suppose. So Fool's Gold is your label, of course.
Yes.
15 years. That's pretty good going.
Thanks. Thanks. It's actually, I'll let you in on a secret. Technically, the label is 16.
Well, I actually had 2007 down in my notes. So I was like,
there you go. But you know what? We even made like hats and t-shirts that say since 2007, and no one has counted. No one said, hey guys, little question. But I don't know. I think with the way things picked up after the pandemic and everything, last year we knew it was our 15th anniversary, but we were just getting a bunch of things back up and running. And I was also doing some Duck Sauce projects and other things. And, you know, we got to sort of like the last quarter of the year, and I was like, shit, we didn't do anything for the anniversary. And we just decided to celebrate in 2023 this whole year.
Yeah, fair enough.
You know, I think everybody's kind of on a what is time mindset after the pandemic. So here we are.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
How when did you start the Hot Flush?
We're actually 20 this year. We've been doing
some amazing.
Yeah. Which really is a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny because I didn't do, we had, this is the first time we've ever done anything to mark any kind of time periods. Like, I remember when it was the 10th year, I was very much like, no, let's not tell anyone. We don't want people to know how old we are.
Okay.
It's this crazy mindset to have. But then this year, you know, it's like, you know, 20 years is quite a long time. We should probably do something to, you know, to mark it somehow.
Yeah. You don't want to be ageist.
No, well, that's, yeah, exactly. Certainly not in the current climate. That could be, it could blow back on you quite badly.
Uh-huh. I know it's Ed Banger's 20 years this year.
Right, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, I think there's, I guess there's a generation, right, of artists who started labels and sort of, I guess, came through around the same time. But I mean, I was going to ask, like, what are the differences for you guys what are the major differences between running a label now and running a label in 2007 when you started, would you say?
A lot. I mean, a lot in the nuts and bolts in you know, obviously just how music is distributed. Obviously streaming didn't even exist back then. So yeah, I would say primarily, you know, we started Fool's Gold when the digital component of a release was an MP3 download. And of course, now we're in the streaming age. I mean, we also saw vinyl sort of go down and then come back up, and you know, everything that went with that, because plants closed down and then people started buying vinyl again, and then it was harder to press vinyl. So all of that. But you know, I think there's the whole sort of direct to consumer business model that's a lot bigger in recent years than it was when we started as well. So we were still kind of, you know, in mostly the old school model of having a label in those years. But I think also in the sense of whether a label is even necessary and the services that a label provides to an artist, there's a lot that's changed because, you know, the ease of access in recent years of platforms like DistroKid and you know, other similar ones where anyone can, you know, upload and sort of self-distribute their own releases, has made it such that an artist doesn't need a label in the same way. I mean, I've also seen a lot of sort of hybrid distributor/labels, you know, rise up in recent years too, where you know, the deals have changed a lot. And there's these companies that are kind of distributors who, you know, offer some label services. But I would say in a general sense, for many years now, we're very aware that artists don't need to sign like to a label like us to put their music out. I also think that a lot of majors are signing a lot more. They're developing less, but they're signing more. So, you know, because there's been kind of a gold rush in the last 5 years, I think, with majors. Ever since the record industry as a whole kind of started turning a profit again, bigger companies have been like, sign, like almost like the stock market, you know?
Yeah, it's very much a kind of volume game, isn't it? Right? It's this throws.
Yeah, so for artists who are looking for a deal, it's not even that hard to get a deal. So if there's an artist who's making great music and we're sort of looking at them, we're very aware that they could also sign to a bigger company with more money, or they could just self-release. Mm. So, you know, we've had to ask ourselves for the last 5, 6, 7 years, you know, very transparently or very frankly, the question of like, why would someone sign to us? You know, so we've really leaned into the curation angle of what we do and the sort of family angle of Fool's Gold. Fool's Gold's a label that also throws a lot of events and has a whole community around it. So to us, if someone signs to Fool's Gold, that artist is probably aware that they're surely aware that they could also put their own music out, or that there's another company out there that, you know, it has an even bigger machine. But chances are they want to be at the company that released maybe some other records that meant a lot to them, you know, coming up, and they want to be part of that lineage, and or they want to be part of this family, maybe play some of the events, or maybe they like our branding, or maybe they just want to get, you know, our ears and our eyes and sort of our help in finishing up something that they can also, that they can already mostly do by themselves. Mm. And that's the type of artists that we mostly sign, are artists that are mostly autonomous, and they'll come to us with usually an album or an EP or something that's practically done. And we just help, you know, get it to that finish line and, you know, connect a few dots, maybe help with a couple guests or help choose like a mix engineer, definitely have fun with the packaging, the artwork, and then how to present it to the world. And then we can get creative with a lot of relationships with, we have, you know, in this community that we're all in internationally. You know, I think in a sense, you know, I think even your label and ours, we're all part of a similar community, even though I've been a fan and admirer of yours for a long time, but you and I haven't really connected before, but I see what you do for years and years. And I feel like we're all part of, you know, there's like-minded people in all cities across the world that are running companies, labels, brands with a similar mindset.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So in a sense, when we put out someone's music, whether it's you on your label or us on ours, we plug these artists into that community where they become also peers with, you know, other like-minded labels and artists, and, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, absolutely. I think that's the danger of going on your own. You know, that's the danger of doing everything yourself, or thinking that you can do everything yourself. Because I mean, technically, absolutely, yeah, you can. Like, I mean, the tools are there for you now as an artist, as a brand new artist as well. You don't need anything really, but actually, there's quite a lot more to it, really, isn't there, than that? There's a kind of, yeah, like you say, a global ecosystem really there, which it being plugged into really, really helps.
For sure. For sure. Exactly.
So let me ask you though about the direct to consumer thing. Is an interesting one, because we've talked a lot about Bandcamp on the show recently, probably too much, to be honest. But how do
well,
you guys?
I'm not big on Bandcamp. So.
Well, that was going to be my question. Yeah. So how do you guys actually do it?
We don't. We're on Bandcamp, but we don't sell merch and vinyl on there. We just make our music available on there. Because we have our own web store, and obviously the percentages, the cuts are better if we just,
of course,
sell out of our web store than if we sell through Bandcamp. And we have cultivated, you know, a decent enough fan base or audience that knows they can buy stuff on store.foolsgoldrex.com, whether it's a, you know, a 7-inch, a 12-inch, a t-shirt, a cap. There's part of me that's always wish that we were bigger on Bandcamp, because that's a very rich community, and I love that ecosystem, and I love how artists mutually support each other on Bandcamp, and a fan will go and buy, you know, something from one label and then buy. I mean, even myself, when I buy music on Bandcamp, I rarely go and buy just one thing.
Yep.
You go from one label to another, one artist to another. So I wish we could be bigger on there, but even on the music side, you know, the Bandcamp is an afterthought to our distributor. I think even in general, you know, as a label nowadays, especially in electronic music, you know, fundamentally, there's this kind of a choice that you have to make early on, which is like, do you want to even try to play the game of streaming services and DSPs? Do you want to try to get any kind of placement on Spotify, Apple Music, Tidal, Amazon, all of those? If so, then you kind of need to go through some sort of traditional distributor. And from the moment you do that, being present on Beatport, TrackSource, BeatSource, Bandcamp, all these platforms that are important to the DJ ecosystem becomes something where you have to like really sort of, you know, stomp your feet with your distributor and be like, hey,
it's crazy, isn't it? It's crazy how irrelevant downloads have become. They're just completely nothing, are they, to those big, well, to any kind of serious distributor?
Yeah. And, you know, we love our distributor, and I'm not knocking anyone in particular here, but like,
oh, it's just the nature of the business, right?
It's the nature of the business. I mean, at the end of the day, the numbers are small. Like, it's, you know, and also I love Beatport, and I've done business with Beatport, and I think they're amazing and essential. It's always a sort of sobering reminder when you find out the numbers of, you know, a Beatport top 10 record, just how many downloads that is. It's small. It's really small. And you know, bless them, and they're important, but it's small. I understand that for, you know, any distribution company, it's not a priority. So we have to have like our own direct relationship with you know, the label reps at Beatport and try to get, you know, try to get some real estate, some placement, and encourage our artists to make charts. And even if we want to give Beatport like a 1 week exclusive on something before it goes on all the other platforms, our distributor just doesn't really get it. And we have to just be forceful and say, we are doing this, you know? And Bandcamp is even less understood, I think, by distributors. The part I don't remember, and there's, you know, thankfully at this point, after this many years, I have a label manager that, you know, handles the nuts and bolts of this stuff. I don't even remember. We might even self-upload on Bandcamp. I don't fully remember that part.
Yeah, I mean, that's normally how it works.
I think so. Because we get to Beatport and TrackSource through our distributor, but I think we self-upload to Bandcamp. But even with that, it's like...
Yeah, that would be...
Yeah. But again, we don't sell our vinyl on there. We don't sell our merch on there. So, you know, we're not big on there.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating thing because it's become such a... like a sort of culturally important brand name, right? I mean, and just using the term brand name would not be popular amongst many of the people that love Bandcamp, right? It's almost this kind of sort of anti-capitalist outpost in the music industry, which is obviously, yeah, the music industry is as capitalist as it gets, isn't it, really? But like, yeah, it's funny how much of a symbol it's become, right? And then the kind of the frenzy of a reaction around the two takeovers that they've been, and I did a big long podcast about it, and you know, basically one of the main takeaways really from, you know, reading all sorts of stuff about it, all the numbers, all the analysis, was really that it's just really small, you know, it's just small, and it's a symbol.
But I also, for so many things, whether it's a marketplace for, you know, DJ focused music or even a career path, for so many things in this stuff that we do, I'm a big believer in you know, equilibrium points and just like finding a sustainable balance where it doesn't matter if something is big or small. It's more about, you know, do the ins and outs kind of match up, and is it sustainable even in, not only in terms of finances, but over time, is, you know, will people come back and, you know, get that same thing again? So I think on a marketplace like Bandcamp, and again, I'm like you pointed out, I'm sure Bandcamp users probably don't even want to use the word marketplace, but whatever, on a platform like that, even if it's relatively small, I do think that there's a ton of repeat customers. I think people go and support artists on Bandcamp Fridays time and time again, and I think that was so essential during the pandemic, right?
Yeah, absolutely, for sure. And I think like it's what it's great for, actually, from an artist perspective more than a label perspective, is the ability to identify people who really do love your music.
Yeah,
right, because those are the people who seek it out, and you've got their email, you know, you can contact them directly. That's hugely valuable, you know, because that's the big issue with DSPs and with streaming. It's like, yeah, I've got X thousand, you know, followers on Spotify or whatever, yeah, X thousand monthly listeners. But who are these people? You've got no way of telling, you know, and
it's
hugely valuable data that you get from Bandcamp. So.
Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, I do think that for me, there's this sort of paradox or thing that I've tried to resolve, and I've never fully found the fix for this, where at the end of the day, a lot of DJ consumers buy vinyl on Bandcamp. And, you know, if you know my history, vinyl is something that, you know, is a big part of who I am. I'm, you know, scratch DJ,
sure,
DMC kid, whatever. So you would think that this platform where a lot of people buy vinyl would be a place where there's 8-track vinyl. And somehow I just, you know, by having the Fool's Gold web store and, you know, all these sort of like behind the scenes infrastructure things that people on the outside don't know about, I've just never been able to like properly get my vinyl performing well on Bandcamp. So, you know, but again, I try to get it to stores. I try to, you know, cultivate a direct audience on the Fool's Gold side, but you want to be everywhere, and it's never actually doable.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, let's talk about vinyl, actually, because you mentioned that there was a big decline and there's been a sort of relative resurgence of it.
Yeah.
And as you say, you know, you know, you're a DMC champion. So, I mean, this is, this must be a hugely important format to you. Yeah, right. Exactly. So tell me about how you feel about the format now. Like, I mean, do you still play with vinyl out?
No, hell no. I'm not a vinyl purist.
Right. Okay.
Actually, the funniest thing, but I scratch at all my shows. A lot of shows I play on CDJs, either with Rekordbox or with Serato connected to CDJs. Sometimes I use turntables with Serato, but I never play with like actual vinyl. There's plenty of shows where I'm scratching on CDJs and then I'll have people come up to me at the set and be like, man, I love vinyl. That was awesome. Vinyl. Yeah. They can absolutely see me on CDJs, but somehow, you know, that's what connects in their brain when they hear scratches and, you know, God bless them. I don't play records. I love records. I think, my own record collection was sort of spread in different cities for years and years. And it's only a year ago that I finally kind of recollected, you know, sort of recalled all the various bits of my record collection in one place. And it's been such a joy this past year to sort of dig through stuff again and rediscover, and also just be amazed at how much I remember records that I bought 20 years ago, 25 years ago. So I'm very sentimentally attached to records, but I absolutely don't play them out and I don't miss it. I don't miss checking in, you know, crates, having airlines lose my crates, stress out about getting to the next city without my record crate. My back doesn't miss it. I'm happy to play on all kinds of digital formats. I still buy records and I'm still happy to press records and sell records for sure. I think, as much as we're in the digital age and, you know, the industry for years tried to push things into the cloud and whatever, however streaming works, you know, everything on your phone, I think people overlooked how much anyone would miss, you know, a tactile experience, just holding something in your hand.
Right.
You know, there's probably a similar conversation about ebooks. I don't know. I'm not in the ebook industry, but, you know, just holding something, the smell of a dusty record sleeve, the attachment you have to your copy of the record that has like some wear and tear on the top right corner and like a little, you know, a little bit missing or a sticker or something written on a marker from the person that had the record before you. All that stuff. There's so much patina and so much attachment to those details. I do think that there's, you know, kind of a paradox with the reasons why people buy records now. I think they've become collectible objects. I don't think anyone really plays a record.
Yeah, you know,
if
I could just interrupt you there. I was
of course
with a good friend of mine today who has a 13-year-old daughter who's great getting very into music and is desperate to buy records, but has no intention of playing them. Absolutely no intention of playing them at all. And just wants them because they're an expression of the music that she likes. It's her saying to the world, I like this music and I have this object to prove it. You know,
yeah.
And that's obviously fulfilling a very different function in the kind of, I guess, the music industry, as it were. But it's still an important function, right?
Absolutely. There's nothing wrong. At the end of the day, we want our fans to feel like they can buy into something we create. And I, as a fan, never stop buying records. But even, you know, it's funny, especially now that my records are back in one place, there's, you know, I'll continue to buy some of my favorite releases of, you know, throughout the months of the year. But in the spirit of completion, I don't want my collection to end at a certain date. But I know very well I'm never going to buy, you know, the LP version of, you know, the vinyl version of whatever album came out that I really liked any given year. I just want it to be part of my collection out of attachment. And like you said, to express that this is an important record to me. But, you know, even the fact that the we're all pressing, you know, various colors and, you know, ink splatter versions of, you know, this record and that record and 7-inch and 10-inch formats. At least for us at Fool's Gold, sell even more than 12-inch because they all have that limited kind of collectible connotation. Very few people are out there playing, you know, said 10-inch. It just looks cool that it's a different format. It, you know, I've gotten to know the De La Soul guys over the years. And, you know, earlier this year, their catalog was finally made available, right? After 20-something years of dispute with their label. And when their new label was distribution partner was pressing up, finally, copies of 3 Feet High and Rising and De La Soul Is Dead and all these classic albums. I'm in a group chat with Pasta News and a bunch of other, you know, DJs and music. Which is awesome. I can't believe that I get to talk to, you know, my heroes like that. And Pasta News jumps in the group chat where he knows there's a bunch of DJs. And he's like, hey, guys, so they're telling us that we should press, you know, the red vinyl, blue vinyl. Someone was telling me that they don't actually sound as good as, you know, regular black vinyl. You know, what do you guys think? And I kind of jumped in and told him, like, whoever's telling you this is right. Like, yes, those limited colorways, that's what the fans want to buy because they want a collectible version of an album they love. And the truth is most people won't really play it out. So that's just kind of what it is.
Which is kind of a shame. But actually, you know, as I just previously said, like, if that's not the primary reason, I mean, that's still fine. It's still okay. You know, if that's what people want, and that's, you know,
it makes people think I'm Mr. Vinyl guy. I myself buy records that I know very well I'm not going to play out. I'll play them in my living room in speakers that look lovely. And that's where they'll get played. And maybe once in a blue moon, I'll do a vinyl set at like one or two venues that friends of mine have. But no, I don't really play these records out. And that's just what it is.
I mean, those De La Soul albums must have flown. They must have had to press an enormous amount, right?
Yeah, and I think I was really happy to see that when those albums finally got properly released this year, that, you know, the team that they assembled for that did it right. They, you know, they made cassettes too, and they made all kinds of collectibles and merch, and it's, you know, I'm a lifelong De La Soul fan. I was happy to be able to, you know, put in my order and just, you know, wave the flag, you know?
100%. So I wanted to talk about, you're from Montreal, right?
Yep. Originally. Yeah.
And I learned 20 minutes ago that your brother is in Chromeo. I didn't realize that. You're from a really musical family.
Yep. Yeah. It's just me and him.
Wow. Okay. So go on. Sorry.
I was just gonna say we make music together now. We've not only are we brothers, but we've always had our hands in each other's projects, you know, since the start.
Yeah,
like anybody that met me, you know, if someone was in the hip hop scene in Montreal in 1996 and saw some 14-year-old kid show up and scratch, you know, at a hip hop event. You know, they also met my brother. He was the tall guy who was like somewhere behind me, probably helping me carry my bag or something, and just kind of whisper some words of encouragement and, you know, give me a little pep talk before I hit the stage.
Right. Yeah. So he's older, I take it.
Yeah. Dave's, we're 4 years apart. He's older. Yeah.
Okay. Got it. So yeah. So tell, okay. I obviously have to ask you this. Like, tell me about becoming DMC champion age 15. I mean, like, how did you start? How did you pick up this, you know, the mixer in the first place?
Yeah. I mean, I started in our parents' basement, kind of like any, you know, hip hop fan.
Was it your brother's decks?
No, it was my dad's belt drive turntable that really wasn't made for scratching. But, you know, I think we were very close even at, you know, even at that age, when I was like, you know, 12 years old and he was 16, I was, whatever him and his friends were listening to, whatever cassettes they were passing around, I would, you know, grab those cassettes and listen to. So when they got into hip hop, I got into hip hop. And, you know, I think in the mid 90s, anybody that heard scratching, you know, on a record tried it at some point. And
I certainly did. Yeah.
Right. And most people tried it and were sort of like, maybe scared off or mystified, or some people sort of tried it casually but sort of moved on. For whatever reason, when I tried it, it didn't sound that bad. I kind of figured it out rather fast, and it just became this passion. And it really just started with that. It started with me having some sort of knack, you know. But then I just really dove in, you know. And I think people have all kinds of things to say about talent and whether you're born with something and, you know, how much is in you from the start and how much is hard work. And the hard work is the bigger part, at least for me. You know,
sure. Let me just ask you, how much music had you done before you started DJing like that? Like, had you learned instruments?
A bit. I took piano lessons after school for about 2 years, I think. Mm. So
yeah,
again, just sort of being around my brother and like really just wanting to be like him. He played the guitar since he was pretty young and was in bands with his friends at school. So there's definitely a big part of me that like wanted to find my instrument, you know, and I tried the piano and I wasn't particularly good at it and sort of gave up. And when I figured out some sort of knack, some sort of, you know, ability with scratching when I tried it, I was also just excited that I found my thing, you know, that I was like, oh, this
that's what I was going to say, right? Because I mean, it really rings a bell with me because I played piano and stuff from a pretty young age, but never really got my head around it. You know, it never really made, I mean, I, you know, it kind of made sense, but it wasn't ever something that I really wanted to do. And it was when I picked up a guitar, actually,
okay,
that it was like, fuck, I can do this, you know? And suddenly it was like, yeah, I want to do this all the time. I was going to sit there on my own and play the guitar because it's fun. And it sounds like it was exactly the same sensation for you, right? You just feel like, I can do this, and it's great, you know, and you just do it.
Yeah. And with scratching, there's so many possibilities that open up. I mean, basically, in the years when I got into it, you know, which is around 95 or so, there was kind of this explosion in scratching in general, where, you know, there was DJs like Qbert and Mixmaster Mike, the Invisible Scratch Pickles, who were revolutionizing scratching itself and what you can do with it. And even just like the identity of a scratch DJ, the word turntablist was coined by this guy, Babu, one of my favorite DJs for life. He was part of a crew called the Beat Junkies in LA. New York had the Executioners, Rock Raider and Rob Swift and you know, Mr. Sinister, Total Eclipse, these four incredible DJs. And there was so much innovation. So, and it was, you know, that era of turntablism was when DJs started saying, we're musicians too. We're using the turntable as a musical instrument. So as I sort of discovered this world, even as a kid, as a 12, 13 year old up in Montreal, you know, not even part of a scene yet, not even able to see a DJ in the flesh anywhere. I was too young to go anywhere.
Yeah, you couldn't go to a club. Yeah, exactly.
No. So, but I would, you know, I found out about the, you know, the VHS tapes of DMC competitions and
that's exactly what I was going to ask you. That's exactly what I was, because
that's how I learned everything.
Yeah, no, because I had a couple of friends at school who, you know, not at your level, but became pretty good at scratching, and that's how they did it. They got VHS tapes and they just watched the moves and they figured it out like that. Yeah, fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, in those years, and obviously the internet was barely nascent, so there wasn't much information that was even available on there. It's that beautiful romantic thing of any subculture, whether you're talking about graffiti, skateboarding, you know, scratch DJing, and you know, all those things are comparable to me because you figure out that that in every city there's a couple people like you who are into what you do, and you start collecting the magazines and the albums that have to do with that culture. And with scratching, as much as with skateboarding, I don't know how to skateboard, but I'm just drawing a parallel. People collect these these VHS tapes, these cassettes, and study, you know, everything about the way that, you know, these superhuman characters are doing this amazing thing. But not only what the tricks are, but, you know, the style itself, how you flow, how you put these patterns together, but also like how you stand, what's your posture when you're doing this thing, what's your expression on your face, what's this like, how do you make it look easy, all the way down to how do you dress. It just becomes this thing that you absorb. So for me, at first I was listening to, you know, albums and cassettes that had scratching on them. So in 94, 95, I was listening to anything that DJ Premier did. I was listening to anything that Pete Rock did. But I was also I was so young that anything I could find was still pertinent to me. So, you know, even Jazzy Jeff and Fresh Prince albums that were 5, 6 years old by then were still new to me. So I was listening to whatever Jazzy Jeff was doing too. But, you know, any hip hop magazine, the Source rap pages. I remember around 94, 95, there was a DJ issue of Rap Pages magazine. And then there was these interviews with Premier, with the Beat Junkies, with, you know, all of my new heroes. And I was just trying to like decipher what they were saying. Right. And there was literally new scratches that were being invented in those years. So I was just trying to figure it out. And then around that same time, my brother started doing a college radio show. And I guess in North America, college radio is probably comparable to pirate radio in the UK. It's kind of where you hear underground music, right?
Sure.
And through doing this college radio show, and he wasn't even old enough to be in uni or college himself, but he sort of like through a friend was able to get a show at this university station. He became kind of a part of the underground music scene in Montreal. And I would sometimes just go and hang out as the younger brother at the radio show. And I met a few local DJs through that, including Kid Koala, who is world renowned to this day, right, but at the time was just kind of making his way up in Montreal. And so when I met some of those DJs, they also showed me videotapes. You know, so I would go to the local record shop, buy the DMC tapes, but some of those other DJs had kind of literally their own video cassette of when Q-Bert came to Montreal a year prior, you know, or a few things like that. And these were, you know, artifacts of information. I would just observe these videotapes and listen to scratches on records. I would even, I would listen to, if I had a copy of if there was a record that had a scratch solo on it, and if it had that on vinyl, I figured out that I could turn the platter off and play that record really slowly and try to decipher a scratch by playing it in slow motion.
Oh, right. Okay. You know? Right.
So
okay.
It was investigative reporting. and
sure.
Yeah. But because I was so young and there was all these new scratches that were being created, you know, around that point in time that the other local DJs were trying to figure out, but you know, it was very new to experienced DJs. For me, I was just taking everything in at the same time. So I was also, you know, initially I was kind of just the first DJ in my city to figure out some of these new scratches that DJs 10 years older than me, you know, couldn't wrap their head around.
Right.
Okay. Because they were used to doing things in, you know, in the traditional way. Whereas to me, I was just taking in all these new sounds, you know, indiscriminately, just, you know, whether it was new or old, you know?
Absolutely.
But yeah, that's how it started. And I entered these battles, you know, pretty soon, pretty quickly.
Let me ask you about the competition element, like, because of the culture here, like, you know, coming from a sort of European, I guess even the kinds of music, well, because I was going to say house and techno kind of viewpoint, but I was very much into sort of drum and bass and that kind of stuff in this period.
Yeah.
We had like DJ Hype, who is kind of like the kind of drum and bass scratch DJ. But I just wanted, in the kind of culture of turntablism, like how important is the competitive aspect and how important then is DMC as a competition?
I would say, especially in that era, that's changed over time, but in that era, in the mid 90s, and I ended up winning I won the DMC in 97. So mid to late 90s, I continued to compete for a couple of years after that. It was, I would say that the DMC and the comparable battle franchises were very central to turntablism. It was the catalyst, it was the playground. There's definitely many DJs who, you know, earned their stripes and became top turntablists without going through the battle arena per se, or without that being the way that they got known. You know, Z-Chip, for example, is one of them. Most turntablists that you heard of went through that arena because there's something about the battle scene that just pushed the competing DJs to innovate. You had to come with something new if you wanted to, you know, beat. Like every DJ was going to do something similar to last year's winner. So if you wanted to stand out, you had to just come with something fresh and new. Mm. And so it really was the playground for innovation. But, and you're right. jungle and drum and bass, that scene was closely connected. You know, I became very close to DJ Craze all the way back in those years and to this day.
Yeah, I was going to mention him. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's my brother. You know, that's he's for life, he's one of the, you know, my closest allies. I mean, literally, we were in a crew called the Allies,
right,
in the DJ scene. And he, you know, he really embraced drum and bass during the years that we were sort of battling side by side. And so I was kind of getting a viewpoint into that scene through him.
Right. Yeah, totally.
But also, like, I was purely a hip hop DJ in those years. And for about 10 years, for the first 10 years of my career, all I cared about was hip hop. But I was, half of my bookings were at raves because raves loved scratching. I think rave kids would trip out watching scratch DJs. And at raves, you know, there was also jungle DJs and drum bass DJs and all kinds of, you know, the other subgenres of electronic music. So I got to know, you know, some of the other subgenres through getting booked at raves. I think raves were really good at sort of connecting dots between all these scenes that were all kind of cousins of each other.
Sure.
You know, that's where everything would come together.
Yeah, absolutely. Just sticking on
I would say that in, go ahead, sorry.
No, I was just going to stick on the competition aspect for a moment.
Yeah.
Can you, what is the format of a competition like that? Like what, like literally what is it?
There's a couple different battle franchises that exist. And each one has a different format. There's kind of two main types of battles. So DMC, which historically has been the better known DJ battle, their format is what we call exhibition style. So each DJ does a 6-minute routine, and each DJ does their routine, their set once. So the judges get to see one DJ after the other, and then they sort of take notes. And just from that 1 6-minute set, they pick, you know, the top three winners. There's other battles that are head to head where there's, you know, quarterfinal heats, semifinals, you know, final round. And those routines, those sets are even shorter. It'll be a minute and a half, sometimes 2 minutes. And you know, that's more sort of like sports style.
Yeah, I mean, that's a pressurized environment right there. It's got to be, right?
Well, and both formats have their form of pressure. Of course, the head-to-head style battle, you know, you're facing off with someone, so that's one type of pressure. But the DMC set, where you have one chance to do this thing that you've been working on the whole year, and if something goes wrong, you that's it. That's your one shot. That's a whole different kind of pressure too.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. So
yeah, and that was how, that's the environment where I had my first experiences for the first many years of DJing. So even just performing under pressure and learning to sort of, you know, block off whatever's going on around me and just get into this, like, you know, Olympic gymnast level type of concentration.
Yeah, right.
That's what I know. Totally. You know, everything. I didn't really know how to DJ aside from that for the first many years.
That was going to be my question. Yeah. So were you able to play in clubs at that age?
I mean, I was getting booked, but people were booking me.
Oh, so you were. Okay.
Yeah, I was, especially once I started winning, you know, even just the local DMC rounds, you know, from the moment I was Montreal champion, then that took me to, you know, being Canadian champion and world champion. From the point I started getting some sort of notice, then people wanted to book me in a couple of different cities. So, I mean, by the way, I also had to, like, I didn't have an agent. I was, you know, 15 years old, learning how to deal with people calling, you know, the house phone at my parents' house and what, you know, figure out my own bookings and you know, pretty quickly learn how to just do my own booking contracts on my parents' fax machine. I had to learn all that stuff at 15, 16. It was pretty funny.
Wow.
And for those early years, either my brother or my mom would accompany me, chaperone me to my shows, especially if there was stuff out of town. And
yeah,
by the time I was maybe 17 or so, 17, 18, I started traveling by myself. But yeah, I had to figure out all that stuff, how to deal with even just like the sort of the responsibility of juggling schoolwork and, you know, doing interviews and photo shoots and magazine stories and bookings, contracts, payments, all that stuff.
Yeah, sure. And when you won it at that age, there must have been a huge amount of press attention.
Yeah, more so than you would imagine now. I think, you know, now for a while now, turntablism and scratch DJing has kind of gone back to being a little bit in the fringes. Mm. Paradoxically, because I think DJs are bigger than ever on awareness level worldwide.
It's a different kind of DJ now, right?
It's a different, yeah, exactly. But in those years, there was a lot of excitement around turntablism and DMC. And on any given year, you know, most, certainly hip hop fans, but even music fans and, you know, people knew who Qbert was, who Rock Raider was, who DJ Noize was, who Craze was. So when I won the DMC, it just, you know, propelled my name kind of around the world. And there, I didn't even fully realize it right away, but there was music fans everywhere who, you know, were just aware that there was, you know, a teenager from Canada called A-Track who was doing something. And I remember getting featured in Interview magazine, which is Andy Warhol's old magazine. Like, it was that type of conversation. It wasn't just like the specialized underground hip hop magazine. It was like all types of experimental music festivals that would book, you know, Amon Tobin and those kinds of artists. And they would book a scratch DJ like myself, like Kid Koala, like Craze or Qbert. Like, we were put into that sphere.
Absolutely.
It's interesting to think back, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to ask, like, was there any, I mean, okay, so there's a lot of press attention and there's a lot of huge amount of interest. Was there any resentment at all from your peers within the turntable community?
A little bit. But I learned a lot of lessons fast from what happened in those years. You know, I met my heroes right away, Qbert, Rock Raider, Mixmaster Mike, those DJs that I was studying on videotape. I met them, right as I was winning those battles, and they all really welcomed me in. In fact, Qbert brought me into the Invisible Scratch Pickles, his DJ crew. But all those DJs that I named really welcomed me with open arms. And it was really moving to feel welcomed by, you know, this older generation of my heroes. And also there was a whole slew of other DJs who, you know, had been trying to win these battles for many years themselves, who, when they saw me win, you know, all had something to say, something sort of dismissive, like, oh, he just won because he looks like a cute little kid or whatever. He doesn't really... If I was in that battle, he wouldn't have won, and that sort of thing, you know? So people kind of testing me right away as I, you know, I hadn't even hit puberty, and like, I'm like propulsed onto this worldwide scene and kind of getting whispers of people sort of testing me from everywhere. And so I had to, you know, build thick skin on one hand and kind of just, you know, have confidence in what I was doing. But also certainly noticed that the DJs who I idolized were very gracious and were able to, you know, there's this sort of like hip hop bravado in that scene where, you know, those heroes of mine, they still had, when it came to their own work, a certain level of confidence and posturing. But when they saw me, they were still able to encourage me and make me feel valued. So I remember sort of just clocking that difference where I was like, okay, well, the ones that really accomplished what I want to accomplish, they're able to show love and give props and, you know, not have this weird sort of insecure thing that I'm noticing. And there's all these other DJs who are talking shit, but I don't even want to be where they're at. So let me just focus on like the path that I want to be on and, you know, and also sort of like show love to other DJs too and sort of, you know, pass it on. And that's, you know, that showed me where I wanted to go.
So let me ask you about the way turntablism has developed. Cause obviously what's happened in the subsequent 25 odd years
yeah.
is as we said, like, you know, vinyl has become obsolete, really, as a kind of performance item. And, you know, all this new technology has come to the fore. So how has turntablism coped with all that stuff? Like, what does a DMC contest look like now?
Now a DMC contest has a lot of different categories. I think, you know, there was a period of probably 10 years where DMC lost touch with some of the progress of the scene. I think they waited too long to allow things like Serato and different kinds of technologies. And it kind of sectioned them off from a whole generation of new DJs that were embracing new technology. Now everything's kind of reconnected. And I, you know, in 2017, I started my own sort of franchise of battles called the Goldie Awards that I've done in New York. And I was even doing online during the pandemic. And, you know, that's something that Craze and a bunch of my friends and peers have helped me organize too. But, and that's a battle that has a DJ category and a beat battle, a producer category for people using all kinds of, you know, finger drumming and you know, MPC-like controllers and whatever they want to use. But nowadays, there's kind of more categories than ever. There's certain battles that are online only where people sort of, the contestants send in their videos and judges just watch the videos from home. There's battles that are still in person. There's team battles. There's a specialized scratching competition, beat juggling competition, this and that. I feel that it's gotten a bit too spread and subdivided, where like the end result is there's a little bit less of a feeling of, you know, one reigning champ compared to
right
to another era. But, you know, the DJs that are competing now are still incredible, and you know, I'm always amazed at seeing, you know, the talent that's out there, and I'm glad that there still is new talent, and actually there's like really young talent. Like every year that we did the Goldie Awards, I wasn't able to organize it this year because I kind of had my hands full with the Fool's Gold anniversary. But every other year since 2017, we threw the Goldie competition. And every year there's someone who's 11 years old, 10 years old, 8 years old. And, you know, it's amazing to see that. I used to be the young one at 15, you know, so I'm glad that that's happening now. And there's a lot of new equipment, you know, in the last 5-10 years that I think kind of like unblocked the creativity sort of blocking that might have been there for a little while. I think there was a period where not much new was being done. And once there started being some of these newer mixers that have, you know, cue pads and buttons on the mixer, and, you know, now there's even new turntables that have, you know, buttons and controllers on the turntables, and the pitch goes even further, and you can, you know, there's even sort of hybrid stuff that's somewhere between production style, you know, machine style pads that can connect to your DJ software, whether it's Serato or Traktor or whatever. That's opened up a whole bunch of new possibilities, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the DJ tech is an interesting thing actually, because I mean, obviously like turntablism is necessarily centered around technical skill, right? And it's something that it's literally what it is. But I mean,
yeah,
like in, I suppose, like house and techno sort of DJing, I mean, I guess the sort of criticism, well, the criticism from old guys like me is that the new tech has made it too easy to DJ, right?
Yeah.
Which is kind of a bullshit complaint. But
well,
I mean,
the sync button and things like that.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, not just a sync button. I mean, it's just very easy.
But just seeing the exact value on CDJs.
Sure, it's just very easy to mix on them. You know? Which is not necessarily a bad thing. But I mean, those of us who, you know, sweated over
turntables
for hours. But what's it? Sorry, I mean, just if I can just finish the question.
Like, yeah, of course.
What has been the developments in the turntablist sector of DJ tech? Like, presumably, it's not been, you know, focused on making things easier, or has it? Like, what's the situation there?
It's made some stuff easier, but it's kind of forced people to get creative with other stuff.
Right.
But the one thing that I think still isn't quite the same, you know, so there's all kinds of new tricks that people can, even I myself can do now with, you know, a mixer that has crazy digital effects, pitch shifting, and, you know, now with, you can be like, you can literally like scratch a record with like, you know, some of your fingers and hit cue buttons with your other fingers at the same time. And all, you know, there's all kinds of things you can do now that didn't even exist before. So it's opened up new possibilities. The one thing that ultimately doesn't quite feel the same to me is the fact that you can make your own records now, which again, I do all the time too. But when we used to have to, when we used to be forced to use something that exists on a record that you bought, and whatever was on that record was all you had access to, and you just had to squeeze ideas out of this record that was in front of you that you didn't make. Forced a type of creativity that paradoxically, right? Like you would think that if you had, now that digitally you can make, put anything, you any idea you can dream up, you can put it on a file, and then that can be like the tool that you use to perform your DJ routine. You would think that that would facilitate the most insanely imaginative routines, but somehow it doesn't quite land the same way as when we were forced to only use what was on a record that we bought, and that's all we had access to.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yeah, having that sort of constraint can be so... It can force you into such creativity, and I think it does. It's the same. Yeah. It's the same in the studio. You know, I think you know, when you it's the classic thing of having endless plugins and you don't know what to do with them. But if you sit there with a drum machine and a kind of bassline generator, suddenly it all works, right? Yeah, I think those sorts of constraints can be amazing. Yeah,
yeah. In over the last 2-3 years, starting the pandemic, I taught myself how to use the SP1200 sampler, right, which has 10 seconds of sample time. Last year, I put out 2 EPs only made on that drum machine. They're called 10 Seconds, Volume 1 and 2, because I'm using the SP. I find that my beats on the SP1200 are probably more original and interesting than what I make on Ableton.
Yeah.
And I've had to just sort of accept that. And I, you know, it's... Yeah, I like how the constraints of that drum machine just forced me to make it work. You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a very real thing.
Yeah, it's actually so fascinating that you said that about records, because I would never have thought that, but it makes so much sense. It really does. It really does.
Yeah. I don't know. And I'm sure a similar thing could be said about sampling, where, you know, if you give a producer 2 records and you say, you know, make a track, make 5 tracks out of what's on these 2 records versus giving them an entire record collection, I'm not sure which outcome will be better. The thing that they make with just those 2 records might be more interesting or cooler or coherent or something, you know?
Yeah, absolutely, man. Absolutely. So, okay. Tell me about coming out of just being a very narrow hip hop DJ into this kind of wider world or the wider ecosystem as we described at the start. I mean, because it's funny you mentioned obviously DJ Craze, and I remember him playing sets in the UK, drum and bass sets, and there being a huge amount of interest, like curiosity, I think probably, like what's this guy going to do with this musical genre. And there was probably, I mean, I was a bit too young to be directly involved in the scene, but I was, you know, I was going to raves and, you know, I was kind of aware of what was going on. But I imagine there was probably a bit of, you know, skepticism amongst the yeah, the DJs, the old heads, maybe. I mean, there must have been a bit.
Probably, yeah. Yeah. People like to say that. I mean, I do think that there is, not talking about craze specifically at all, but there is a thing where a lot of scratch DJs don't fully manage to break out of that hyper-specialized branch and sort of break into the world of clubbing and festivals or original production and music. It's a leap that's hard to do.
Absolutely.
And that was phase one of my career. You know, the even when we talk about the Fool's Gold anniversary at the start of our conversation, you know, that my label is 15 or 16 years old, depending what truth you go by. But Fool's Gold is like phase two or three of my career. You know, I've been DJing for 27, 28 years. In fact, I had another record label with my brother when we were coming up in the Montreal scene, an underground hip hop label called Audio Research, where we put out underground hip hop records. And that, doing that, you know, gave me some of the lessons that, or, you know, some of the know-how to start Fool's Gold, you know, 10 years later. But yeah, breaking out of the scratch world was kind of a leap, and even just getting into different genres has been a whole path that kind of happened over many, many years. And if you go see me play now, I play mostly house and you know, things related to house, and mix in some classics and you know, some faster stuff, some slower stuff too. And I, you know, of course I still play some hip hop sets. I kind of play everything. And I think I play house music with the touch and approach of a hip hop DJ.
Yeah.
But hip hop is not the main thing that I play now. Whereas, you know, there was, like I mentioned, the first 10 years of my career, it was all I played and all I cared about. So it's been a whole path. But I think part of that has to do with just how young I was in that first phase, when I was only in the underground hip hop scene and only in the scratch scene. You know, I retired from battling at 18, you know, so it's like at that age, it was sort of, I was still young enough to be able to absorb new things and learn new things and learn how to properly rock a party. And then, you know, one thing that was pretty
Can I just interrupt you? Because there's a couple of specific things I want to ask.
Yeah.
Because when I was reading about all this, what it really reminded me of, and this is maybe way off the mark, but you know how amateur boxers have a big circuit they do, and then someone to make it to the Olympics. And if you win a gold medal at the Olympics, you go pro.
Yeah.
It almost reminded me of that. Your career trajectory sort of reminded me of that. That's an observation.
Yeah.
But the kind of more specific thing I wanted to ask was, when you stopped doing straight hip hop, was that a big statement in your career? Was that a very much a kind of, I want to do something different now? Or was it kind of more of a gradual thing?
Somewhere between both. It happened gradually. But there was definitely a point in the early 2000s where I realized that I was still playing a lot of 90s hip hop and that I was kind of stuck in a loop. And then I made a concerted effort to break out of that loop. And there's a few things that I think coincided in the early to mid 2000s, some of it being technology, where I met the people who founded Serato and I became the first Serato endorsee. And making that transition to digital files made it easier for me to also download and trade and just grab music of different genres at a point in time where hip hop was a little boring to me, around 2003 or four or whatever. And I was just kind of more excited or becoming excited about whether it be like just mastering some of the classics and the older stuff to then in the mid 2000s, discovering a new type of electronic music on blogs and just being like, well, what's this sound? What's this? What's Justice? What's Crookers? What's Soul Wax? What's, you know, Mastercraft? What's all this stuff? This sounds crazy. Sinden and Switch, of course, you know, and sort of like mixing in hip hop acapellas and vocals with this weird new sort of electro thing that I was discovering online. All those things came together. But at any one of those little steps that I took, whether it be using a laptop with the first version of Serato or, you know, starting to venture into different sounds beyond hip hop, each one of those steps felt like kind of a risk or a leap. Like, all right, I'm going to try this and I hope people rock with it. And I just sort of kept exploring. And once I started playing, you know, a broader selection of genres, I also found an energy at my shows that was so contagious and more exciting than that traditional, just sort of head nod.
Yeah, I mean,
traditional hip hop. I like that.
That was my next question, right? Yeah, that was my next question. So, how much kind of, so you got a great reaction from the crowd? Because that's by no means a given, right?
Yeah. So it worked with crowds, and
what about the people in the hip hop community and the turntables community? What did they think about your move here?
Fortunately, a lot of my peers were sort of curious about it and also ventured into that in the years that followed, because that could have gone different ways. You know, I've had plenty of conversations with some of my DJ friends who changed genres. I remember having a great conversation with Zinc 10 years ago about when he went from, you know, when he went from jungle to house, and what that was like for him. And, you know, obviously with Craze, I talk about that too. But for me, going from hip hop to all this other stuff, I don't know if it's because the way that I spun the records still felt like me. The people that came to my show still supported it, but I also made a concerted effort to go and find a new audience too. And, kind of just explore this new, there was a new scene that was taking shape in North America, and then like sort of connecting dots with people in other cities and other countries and continents too. By then, by the mid 2000s, you know, through MySpace and, you know, just that scene that I was describing of kind of a new, I mean, now we call it Bloghouse, but just kind of everything that was all the sort of experimentation that happened online.
Yeah.
I really embraced that scene. And I moved to New York in those years and kind of like fell into a scene here in New York and in some of the neighboring cities that was really exploding in those kinds of parties and genres. And so when I experimented with different genres, I wasn't even really playing for my old audience that much. I was going and finding a new audience that was into this new music that I was into. That new audience welcomed me, and my old audience kind of saw it and they were down. And I was able to connect those dots between, you know, those generations. And that became a pretty big thing for the whole rest of my career. It was like that cross-generational thing. But I also think that, like, in a sense, we spent a good amount of time here talking about, you know, my teenage years as a scratch DJ and a battle DJ and my years in the underground hip hop scene. But I think when you zoom out, there's a mentality that I embraced in those years that stayed my mentality all through the years, all the way to now, in terms of what I'm drawn to and what type of environment and creativity I like to keep myself surrounded in. Where, like, at the end of the day, like, the mid-90s underground hip-hop scene was very independently minded. People were pressing their own vinyl, you know, had direct relationships with the record stores and the journalists and all this stuff in different cities. And it was DIY. It was indie minded. And just kind of groups of friends figuring out how to do stuff together, you know. And I think every couple of years, the music scene and music industry goes through cycles where things go back to that mentality, where there's kind of a sea of change and it becomes ripe for, like, again, just a couple of friends getting together and being like, no one else gets it. Let's just do this shit ourselves and figuring it out, you know? And I think, you know, in a sense, that mid 2000s era that I'm describing, which ended up being, you know, the backbone for my friends and I starting Fool's Gold, and, you know, the years where, you know, you'd get on MySpace and find, you know, just cool, weird, new bootlegs and mashups and remixes by the producers I was just naming. That felt like a return to that mindset of DIY, of kind of breaking the rules and just the parties and the nightlife being the breeding ground as opposed to the industry, like going from the bottom up rather than top down.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, that was the spirit for founding Fool's Gold. And, you know, in the years that followed, things got bigger than things, you know, and not even just for us, but for the scene, you know, America discovered electronic music on a bigger level, and then things kind of crashed and built again and all this stuff. But every few years, I love to find these moments that feel like we can just roll up our sleeves and just do stuff ourselves. Whether I'm making house, you know, whether Armand and I are doing Duck Sauce, and, you know, or I'm doing house music by myself on my SP-1200, or I'm trying to foster the next generation of battle DJs of all genres with the Goldie Awards or whatever, or just, you know, running Fool's Gold in an independent business that does its own, you know, events and branding and merch and all this stuff. It's always that DIY mentality and approach, you know, and I think there's certain people who might have, over time, who may have discovered me from one or two tracks that I made that got bigger, you know, here and there, whether it's Barbara Streisand or Heads Will Roll, and they might think that I'm operating, you know, on this bigger scale, and then sort of realize that, like, all I care about is really just, you know, supporting my friends' music and you know, keeping my feet in the underground and just finding cool, weird shit. Like, that weird is a positive word for me. And I just look for, you know what I mean? That's what I look for through time.
Absolutely. So I've got to ask you about Duck Sauce, because our man is, I've never met him, but obviously he's a legendary figure because of his influence on UK garage as much as anything else. For anyone in the UK, that's like, that's the shit that we fucking, I mean, he is unbelievable. The legend of Armand van Helden is just incredible in the UK scene because of those, because of those tunes. But before we do that, let me just ask you about being Kanye's tour DJ, because that's something I didn't realize until, again, like this afternoon.
A lot of people sort of discovered me through that too. There's people that have found out about me through all kinds of pockets over the years, and then I try to make sure they know about the rest of the stuff. So yeah, that was a big part of it.
Yeah. So let me ask you specifically. I mean, Kanye's come up once before on this podcast with someone who knows him directly. Uh-huh. So what's he like, actually?
I can't tell you what he's like now, and I'm not interested myself in knowing what he's like now, because he's crossed a couple lines I don't think we should give him our attention right now, but I can tell you what it was like in 2004. I worked with Kanye from 2004 to the start of 2008 for almost 4 years. Was a close collaborator of his, technically was his tour DJ, but scratched on some of the records he produced, from Gold Digger to some of the Common albums he made. Played him Daft Punk, like, introduced him to the French, the Busy P and those guys. But we all, you know, and we even just shared a lot of resources. He and I helped each other out with a lot of, you know, branding, creative direction kind of conversations. He and I met and worked together in a period where both of us in our respective careers, even though mine was much smaller than his, were very fruitful periods of change, sort of formative years, you know? I met him right after the College Dropout album came out, and he needed a tour DJ. We met in London. He saw me DJ at Deal Real Records in London.
Really?
And that led to a 4-year working relationship. And he was an extremely stimulating, curious, sort of all-absorbing person to be around. And it was super inspiring to work with someone who approached everything with such a huge vision, you know, who, while he was making a beat, would think about, you know, what the video would look like, what the artwork would look like, who'd be featured on the song, you know, all that stuff while he's chopping up a snare. Like, that kind of thinking big. I came from such an underground scene that it really changed how I thought. And at that point in time, Kanye's music, if you remember those, especially the first two albums, you know, he brought back a type of soul sampling approach to hip hop after a couple of years where everything was very synthesized and dry. He brought back sampling, was bringing back kind of the spirit of, you know, A Tribe Called Quest and RZA, Wu-Tang kind of production, this sort of authentic thing. But he was able to make really big songs with, you know, what felt like an authentic sound. And that influenced my approach to DJing and turntablism too, where it kind of put, and, you know, he had me do scratch solos in front of huge, you know, stadium crowds. And I had to figure out how to do something similar with my craft, where I came from this very quote unquote authentic place. And I wanted to sort of tweak and rearrange my performances and tricks to make them accessible to all kinds of audiences without compromise. I think he was able to do that with his music at that time, especially. And I took that on as a challenge, literally for scratching. Like, oh, what kind of scratch, you know, beat juggle routine can I do? Like the first tour I did with Kanye, we were opening for Usher. So I was playing for Usher fans and he wow. wanted me to do like a minute and a half solo. Well, what do you do? Like the
really
the Usher fans in 2004 don't even know what a turntable is. So, and they can barely see me. We're in an arena or a stadium. What do I do to still get a crowd reaction? It was an incredible challenge, you know, and I learned a ton from doing that. So that's what those years were like to me. And it's in the middle of that stint of working with him that I started also on the side messing around with electronic music and starting to produce more and starting to make remixes and started Fool's Gold. And I kind of left the Kanye gig because I started Fool's Gold and I needed to have more time to nurture this new thing.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Amazing. It was a huge part. And it was definitely a big factor to answer your earlier question of me breaking through post battle phase of my career.
Right.
You know, it was this big jet engine that introduced me to a whole bunch of people after I stopped battling. And they helped me figure out like a career path.
Yeah. I mean, it's an incredible opportunity, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Totally. I mean, that's fascinating. So, okay. Let's jump ahead then to working with Armand van Helden, as I mentioned,
most
of the people listening to this are going to be British probably, and they all know the tunes. It's difficult to overstate how big those tunes were in the UK. Like it's mad.
Yeah.
So yeah, how did you start working with them?
We became friends first, and I think I had to also get to know the character. Armand is. One of one, a very special human.
I mean, he's a larger than life figure, man, just looking at him from afar, but like he does seem to be a big personality.
Yeah, but also he has his own way of working where, especially in those years, you know, you hear of Armand van Helden and you hear of like this huge output of music. He made so many tracks, especially in the 90s. And then when I met him, I met him in 2006, right when I moved to New York. And we kind of clicked right away and started hanging out. But at first, you know, there's a few times where I suggested that maybe we collab or try something. And he was sort of politely, was like, oh, I'm just chilling this week. I'm just hanging out. And I sort of came to realize that he had this sort of leisurely life where he really just hung out on most days and maybe went tanning or maybe went for a walk or just walked on the sidewalk and picked up rare books or records from some weirdo on the sidewalk sale. And once in a while would go in the studio and make a track. But that track was Dizzy Rascal Bonkers or My. Like that's, but right. He wasn't hustling every single day trying to make that track. He was spending most of his time just chilling. And once in a while he would go and make Bonkers. Which is crazy, but that's how he is.
That is crazy.
Yeah.
That's so far removed from how I have to work in this year. I have to throw so much stuff at the wall for get something to stick, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I really do.
Yeah, and he's told me that in his earlier years, he did the grind for sure, but he developed this sort of like inner compass or something where he just knows how to aim and he gets it. And he has obviously amazing ears. And I think there's a few things about him. He's just kind of always drawn to new sounds and different shit. And he just kind of gets it year after year. But initially I just moved to New York we met up. I think there was kind of a kindred spirit thing where we're both hip hop kids who got into house music, but, you know, are more attached to hip hop identity, regardless of what we make or play as DJs. That was already the case back when I met him. So I think he saw me and thought it was kind of interesting that, you know, A-Track, the DJ that he remembers hearing as a battle, you know, DMC guy, was now messing around with new kind of house electro and whatever, you know, new sound was happening in those years, and was making something kind of similar to the music he made. So I think he was curious. I was just psyched to meet Armand Van Helden, and yeah, we just became friends, and it's only 2 or 3 years later that we finally sat down and made music, and we, you know, started Duck Sauce and kind of figured out a sound sort of right away. And for me, it was always this dream of, you know, having access to his records, where, you know, I would just go to his apartment. He lives in Miami now, but at the time he lived in New York. I lived in New York too. I would just go to his place and I would kind of just, he would play me samples, and I would choose something, and then we'd make a track together. So yeah, it was great fun. Great fun. And I think, you know, we sort of stumbled into a sound that maybe felt refreshing to people. Because when we started, you know, Duck Sauce, and the first song we put out was Anyway in 2009, you know, that very distorted electro sound was really, really big for many years at that point. And everyone was just like trying to out-distort their distortion and just make the loudest bass lines imaginable. And then we've just kind of had this instinct, this hunch to make a palate cleanser and just, you know, loop up a Philly disco record. And I think Anyway kind of fell on welcoming ears. And so that first record was, you know, pretty well received. And then the following year we made Barbra Streisand, and that just kind of went out of control. Yeah.
I mean, who came up with the hook? Whose idea was it to put that hook in?
It was a group effort. Ultimately, it was him, and it's his voice.
Really?
But yeah, it was kind of... Yeah, it's his voice. I mean, there's other records where we've both used our voices on our songs. We just kind of, you know, tweak effects on it. But he's got a great voice.
Genius in its simplicity, right? I mean, the first time you hear that, it's just in your head. You're never going to forget that, you know?
Hopefully, yeah. I don't know.
Seriously, because it's on one level, it's fucking dumb. But on another level, it's really pop genius.
Well, yeah, it's mostly dumb. It's mostly dumb. Maybe a little bit of pop genius, maybe. I don't know. Or at least there's something catchy there. I think Armand and I realized, especially when we made that song, that when we link up, when we get together, we have this little sense of humor that we share, where we just get into ridiculous stuff, and the weirder and funnier we get in our thought process as we create songs, the more unique the result is. So we end up just sort of like fostering that, and just we get into like our little zone. We're like, you know, Beavis and Butthead, the cartoon Beavis and Butthead. the American thing, just these two idiots. That's how he and I feel when we're together. So we just get into like our you know, stupid little jokes, and make tracks in that mindset. And yeah, that's it.
That definitely comes through on the records in a good way. So how did you guys feel? When I say you guys, I mean the North American contingent doing this kind of, in this kind of musical area. How did you guys feel about EDM when it became huge?
I think that, you know, that was a kind of a complex thing, in the sense that it turned into kind of a tornado, and it turned into a thing that even those of us in the scene that really had our hands in laying down the groundwork for that scene to take off the way that it did, there's a point where you feel like it slips out of your hands, and it turns into a whole thing that you can't control. And sometimes the sound even changes, or the aesthetics change to something that you sometimes don't even like anymore. But for me, it was always important to keep a positive outlook. I think some people were soured by just what that became, especially during those, you know, the first half of the 2010s, during those years. But, you know, so there's a little bit of a be careful what you wish for kind of sense with what that became for a few years. But for me, you know, ever since I was a teenager scratching, I wanted DJing to have legitimacy. I wanted people to take DJs seriously. I wanted DJs to be taken seriously as performers, as musicians. So when DJs started being put on main stages, on the first stage, on the big stage of a festival or on the cover of magazines, even though some of my friends and peers would be like, oh, but that DJ is easy, or that, for me, it's more like, but our scene wins. Like, we, as a collective, we win, you know? And there was a whole bunch of, you know, pressure and expectations that came with that. And it turned into, you know, a whole crazy arms race of, you know, who's got stage production and who's making a song that hits this or that chart on top 40 radio, this or that. It turned into a whole thing. And it was a whirlwind. And I'm certainly more fond of the years where things feel more independent compared to what happened during like that boom of EDM, especially in North America. But it also helped us grow a whole new audience of a new generation that became really curious. And maybe their gateway was some record that some of us find cheesy, but then they were like, well, what else is there? And then they start listening to other cool stuff, your label, all kinds of great shit, you know? So, you know, it was the way in for a lot of kids.
Yeah. I hear you on that, definitely. And I think there was a broad, I mean, there was an element to it which was ultimately, I think, useful and positive.
Mm-hmm.
And it was easy, I think it was easy to be down on the music at the time, because let's face it, quite a lot of the music was pretty bad.
Yeah, EDM became a dirty word.
Yeah, with some justification, I would argue, you know?
Yeah, sure. It became like hair metal. It 100%.
Right. You know,
You know, like the stage shows. DJs were making ballads. It became that's not what we got in this for. It certainly became like hair metal. But by the way, I like some hair metal, there's a similar virtuosity. You know, there was like new young DJs who to me were like Joe Satriani of Ableton.
Right.
And Joe Satriani is not a cool guitar player, you know? But so this sort of like prodigious, but like not anchored in what we all think is cool, that phenomenon, that certainly happened to our scene. But I don't know, things happen how they happen and scenes change. And I do think that in hindsight and in the big picture, it helped DJing get a certain level of legitimacy. That it helped, you know, the industry itself build more of a structure, even in terms of, you know, management companies, festival companies, like just, you know, a certain like back office thing that was like missing for a long time finally got added and or built out. That's what happened when money comes. And, you know, the EDM scene definitely crashed after a couple of years in North America. All those Vegas casinos that were booking tons of DJs, you know, pivoted a few times. And you know, then like tech house became EDM. Like there's a bunch of things that happened in recent years. But,
sure.
You know, for me, it's always a question of just constantly searching, trying to find the cool shit, trying to find the next shit, just kind of challenging myself. Like there's a... Even just as someone who started as a scratch DJ and who now makes electronic music and who, you know, signs and helps develop artists or whatever, there's a certain adulthood that I reached in my DJing where I felt like there's plenty of DJs that I idolize and that I model myself after, but there might not be one singular DJ that is my role model. I kind of tried to get to a point where I could just make my own path, you know, while paying respects to everyone, of course, but I really have tried to make my own path for a long time now. And so even with that mindset, when there's elements of the scene that I don't love, or when things get a little cheesy here and there, I'm sort of like, okay, well, where am I going to go? Or what am I going to do about it? Or what could I make to try to take things in the direction that I want?
Yeah, absolutely, man. Totally. So yeah, this has been great, man. Let me just ask you a couple more to finish up, a couple more general ones. Do you think that DJs break records in the same way that they used to these days? Like the DJ filled a very specific function of in the music ecosystem of breaking a record, particularly dance records. Do you think that still works in the same way?
Not in the same way. Not on the same scale. To a certain extent, yes. I think nothing will ever replace when there's a record that gets played everywhere and it just kind of, you know, catches on like wildfire. And nothing is as sustainable as solid as when it starts, you know, from the underground and from the DJs. But there's certainly some dance records that break on streaming, on radio or elsewhere. And, you know, and we're kind of in this weird period where something needs to connect the dots. Like if there's a song that's big in clubs, labels are looking at Shazam charts because they want people to go from the club to Shazam to Spotify or whatever, you know, or like something breaks on TikTok, but then labels hope that also, that's the funny thing to me is when something's big on TikTok and then DJs start playing it because they know that the audience has heard that song on TikTok. Like there's something kind of strange and backwards about that to me, going from TikTok to the club to then maybe Spotify or somewhere else.
Yeah, totally. It's also a different, a slightly different expectation, I think, from the audience nowadays, from what they expect from a DJ, I find. I mean, and I think you can overstate that. I mean,
For sure. People go see a DJ as if they're going to see a band and they expect you to play your biggest song.
Right.
Of course. That role of the DJ as the sort of take me on a journey character mm-hmm. has turned into, yep. I mean, I get out of my shows, people, I can tell the sort of casual fans who haven't seen me play before, but who know some of my records on Spotify, who within 10 minutes of my set will flash their phone in my face that says, play Heads Will Roll, you know, 10 minutes in.
Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay, man. Well, listen, last question.
Yep.
What's your number one place to find new music?
I don't even know if I have one answer for that. It's really
okay.
A couple. I look at Beatport charts by other DJs. I'll check out, you know, again, charts and playlists by DJs I like, and go track stuff down on Bandcamp. Once I'm on Bandcamp, I go down rabbit holes there. I do check out Spotify playlists, of course, but it starts with one thing, whether it's someone's playlist, and then I go and discover from there. That's usually how I find stuff.
Yeah. I mean, music discovery is a thorny topic. It's something we've talked about a lot on the show. And it's difficult now, I think. I think it is tough.
Well, yeah, because everything's on the internet in one way or another. And like everyone has the same internet. So how, as a DJ, you have access to the same music as your fans, your audience, the people that are listening to you. But we have to find things that they haven't found. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
Anyway, man, listen, thank you so much for your time, man. It's been great.
Man, thank you so much. It's really a pleasure. I've been a fan of yours for a long time. It's really great to finally connect.
Yeah, that was A-Track. That was really fascinating, I thought, in certain respects. Anyway, it was amazing to hear him talk about turntablism and the changes. That was really interesting, actually, the changes in turntablism over time as different technologies have affected it, and the constraints that you used to have from scratch records. That was really interesting. Really, really interesting. And what a nice guy. What an interesting guy. It's funny because I think the people, generally speaking, the people who stick around in the music industry are actually usually pretty nice. Like, there's a lot of dicks in the music industry, but the people who endure are usually the good ones, I find. I mean, there are exceptions to that, of course. But I think generally speaking, that's a rule of thumb which generally holds up. And yeah, he absolutely is one of the good guys.
So yeah, amazing to have him on. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Okay, that's about it for us this week. A reminder that you can support the show on Patreon, patreon.com/scubaofficial. One of two very well-priced tiers on there, £3.50, $4 US or £8.50, $10 US per month. Lots of goodies that go with each of those levels. You can also donate directly to the show via PayPal or a credit card on scubaofficial.io/support. If you particularly liked an episode, then sling us a few quid. That'd be nice of you. It really does all help, I have to say. It genuinely does. So yeah, if you don't want to do that, if you don't want to support financially, completely understandable. And I feel like a bit of a dick asking for it, to be honest, but such is life in the 21st century. You can do something nice by following the show wherever you're listening to this podcast. Hit the 5-star button on the ratings and leave us a gushing review if you feel so inclined. That would also be nice. That really would help too. That would be good. Follow the Spotify playlist. There's a link in the show notes to the playlist. And join us in the Discord for a chat. hotflushrecordings.com/discord gets you into our Discord server. And there's a lot of nice people in there for you to talk to, as well as myself as well. So if you have anything to say to me about the show, that's the place to do it. Okay, this has been a fun episode. I will see you back here for episode 99. Same time, same place next week for the next episode. Episode 99. But not a diving podcast, thank you.
Not a diving podcast, but scuba.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.